It is 3:06 on Friday afternoon. The weekend is coming. You're listening to Political Rewind. We're broadcasting live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Jim Galloway, my partner, who is the political writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and oversees the Political Insider blog, is with us. Jim, you're working on a column for Sunday. You want to give us a little preview?
Yeah. What did that march in Atlanta mean after Trump's inauguration? I mean, is that the beginning or the end?
Oh, very good. All right. Well, maybe we'll talk a little about that. State Senator Nan Orrick, Democratic senator, is here with us today from Atlanta. We're glad to have you back, Nan.
Great to be with you. What a crowd.
Big crowd. Greg Bluestein, who is, of course, political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joins us. Greg, hi.
Thanks for having me.
And Greg just came from reading to his six-year-old daughter's class. You're a dad.
Isn't that sweet?
These wonderful dulcet tones enthralling the kindergartners.
Oh, great. And Eric Tannenblatt, one of the best-known Republican insiders really in the South, back again. We're so happy to have you here, Eric. You were at the inauguration. We haven't seen you since then.
Did
you
have not, yes.
Big time?
Yes, had a great time.
Okay.
Exciting
which,
times.
Which ball did you go to, Eric?
I did not go to an official inaugural ball, but I did go to the Georgia State Society ball the day before the inaugural.
Okay. That's old news, so we're not going to talk about the inauguration anymore, but we obviously have a lot to talk about, and we do have. Boy, let's get talking about politics. As we do, though, a couple of quick pieces of business. First of all, I want to remind everybody that we are now looking to put together our next citizen panel show. And we do that by asking you to tell us why you think you should be a member of our panel. We'll do that show sometime mid-February. And if you think you're the perfect choice to be on the show, here's the phone number to call, 678-757-4472. 678-757-4472. We'll repeat it again before the show is over today. I will remind you, the longer your message, the less chance that you're going to get selected to be on this panel. Lisa Clark recorded the message, talks succinctly to her, and we'll be calling you back if it sounds like you're a good choice for the panel.
Short but compelling.
That's right. Short but compelling. Also, you can tweet us throughout the show today at PoliticsGPB. And I do want to tell you that we've already gotten a couple of tweets in. Edward Adams says, it's only been 1 week, and I think I'm developing Trump fatigue. Media apathy is a concern, and maybe I need a Trumpcation. All right. Thank you for that. So we'll listen to we'll read your tweets throughout the show today as well. All right, let's get started. We have some breaking news. President Trump held his first news conference since being sworn in. Of course, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Theresa May, has been here today for meetings. Jim, they're hoping that in the post-Brexit world, they can create a trade deal that will benefit Great Britain even as it backs away from the EU.
Right. But at the same time, they're on very different sides when it comes to NATO. Britain's prime minister is very much about holding it together. Trump is not so much.
Yeah. Well, not according to the prime minister at the press conference. And she turned to the president and said, now you're 100% behind NATO, right? And so he said that. He said he was.
Okay, today he was.
All right. It's going to be really interesting to watch how that relationship plays out, of course. Let's listen to just this was a what was interesting, Nan Orrick, this was a short news conference. We're used to, especially when two leaders of nations come together, about an hour for these things. I didn't put a clock on it, but I did keep track. I think there were they allowed six or maybe seven questions.
And did you notice that the president didn't really make a very elaborate opening statement?
Very
he just
short.
Welcomed her. The prime minister actually spoke longer.
Yes, exactly.
She brought the substance. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, okay. You know, we'll let our listeners determine that. but there were some interesting comments. The British reporters they asked him a couple of tough questions.
And he handled himself
Got to say, he was a little bit funny. the first British reporter who asked him a question really laid it out. How can we trust you? You change your mind all the time. And of course, Trump responded by saying, this is the question you want, talking about Theresa May, who has some say in which of the British reporters would get to ask questions. But she did ask him about torture, and he repeated something he said fairly recently, but it's worth listening to again. Does he believe that torture is an effective method for getting information?
We have a great general who has just been appointed Secretary of Defense, General James Mattis, and he has stated publicly that he does not necessarily believe in torture or waterboarding or however you want to define it. I don't necessarily agree, but I would tell you that he will override because I'm giving him that power. He's an expert. He's highly respected. He's the general's general. And so I'm going to rely on him. I happen to feel that it does work. I've been open about that for a long period of time. But I am going with our leaders.
Interesting change of tone. Do we think it's going to stick?
Greg maybe. Bluestein? I mean, he's that's a big deal that he's deferring to his Secretary of Defense and, you know, on such a controversial issue. I think it might stick.
I think it will. And I think that this is really telling in terms of what kind of cabinet he's going to have. You know, presidents, recent presidents, their cabinet secretaries have not really been able to act independently. They took direction from the White House. And, you know, most of President Trump's cabinet secretaries haven't been confirmed yet. But those that have, he seems to be very deferential to them. And so we can actually have a government with a functioning cabinet where the president actually listens to his cabinet secretaries.
I think it'll stick out in the open. But one thing you do have to remember is we've got some executive orders being drafted that would reestablish black sites, which are going to be in other countries if they are recreated under different laws operated by different people.
So we should be careful when we talk about that, because the New York Times and the Washington Post have said absolutely for certain the documents which relate to the reestablishment of black sites and talk about torture are authentic White House documents. The White House continues to deny that and to say, we don't know where these came from, but they're in dispute to some extent, Ann Orick.
Well, we'll see more of that, I'm sure, rather than less in terms of dispute, because to Eric's point, I mean, we've got cabinet members that I'd hate to see run away with a bit in their mouth in terms of what their past history is and their record.
Who are we talking
well,
about?
Well, the Labor Secretary nominee is a great example. He's against minimum wage, for the Lord's sake, much less, you know, working to close the wage gap that we've got in this country.
Well, the election's behind us. The Democrats lost. So, you know, the president won, and he gets to put together his cabinet. And the people that he has pulled out of the private sector, I think, are quite impressive, including the Secretary of Labor.
Well, he's not what I would call impressive. I mean, when you can put his record up.
But you didn't support him when he ran for president, so I wouldn't expect you to support his appointees.
Well, there were a million-plus people in the streets last Saturday, the day after his.
And most of those people didn't support him either.
That's right. A majority of the popular vote went against Trump.
Right.
It's actually a 7 million vote gap when you take the Hillary's 3 million and the other 4 million that went to other third party
candidates.
I know.
And you're a respected legislator. And
thank you, Eric.
But the election is now behind us. So now we all want to wish our new president well, and we should give him a chance.
I think we should give him a chance to stop talking about his election. Yes. I agree.
Rid, welcome that. Yes.
Well, okay. I don't want to go too far down the line with this. But I do think it's safe to say that Nan points to Andy Pudzer, the candidate for Labor Secretary. And of the many cabinet choices who some people have, you know, doubts about, including our own Tom Price, Pudzer's the one who people really do wonder about as Labor Secretary, because he has a record that suggests he's not exactly pro-labor.
Well, that's what you say now. It was Scott Pruitt.
Well, it's based on his background.
Well, when Scott Pruitt was nominated, the EPA administrator, it was Scott Pruitt because of his positions you know, on clean air. And, you know, every cabinet secretary, when they were first nominated, people were critical of them for some reason or another. And so now you're focusing on the Department of Labor. I think you got to give these people a chance.
All right.
Well, look at energy. Rick Perry finds out on the way to his hearing that he's in charge of the nukes.
Okay, I don't want to. I'm sorry. I'm going
to. Yeah, we don't need to relitigate the election. It's behind us.
Well, I'm going
to
cut this short.
That's not relitigating the election. That's moving forward.
I'm going to cut this short because I really want to get on with sharing with you all and getting your reaction to some of what Trump said in this news conference today. Of course, he was asked. He's going to have a phone call, Greg Bluestein. We've learned there's a phone call arranged between him and Vladimir Putin on tomorrow. Saturday. And there's a lot of speculation as to what that call is going to be about. Is there a potential that he may talk about lifting sanctions under certain circumstances, right? The president did not say specifically what that's about today.
He wouldn't say it, but I think the speculation is probably going down the right line that there are going to be a thawing in the relationship. It was sort of forecast throughout the entire election process that the negative energy will now focus more on China than Russia. I think we're going to start seeing that, you know, play out.
All right, let's listen to how President Trump responded to a question about this phone call and what he hopes to accomplish.
As far as the sanctions, very early to be talking about that. But we look to have a great relationship with all countries, ideally. That won't necessarily happen. Unfortunately, probably won't happen with many countries. But if we can have a great relationship with Russia and with China and with all countries, I'm all for that. That would be a tremendous asset. No guarantees, but if we can, that would be a positive, not a negative.
All right, and before we discuss that, let's listen to what he had to say just a few minutes later about the kind of relationship he hopes to have with Mr. Putin.
As far as, again, Putin and Russia, I don't say good, bad, or indifferent. I don't know the gentleman. I hope we have a fantastic relationship. That's possible, and it's also possible that we won't. We will see what happens. I will be representing the American people very, very strongly, very forcefully. And if we have a great relationship with Russia and other countries, and if we go after ISIS together, which has to be stopped, that's an evil that has to be stopped, I will consider that a good thing, not a bad thing. How the relationship works out, I won't be able to tell you that later. I've had many times where I thought I'd get along with people, and I don't like them at all. And I've had some where I didn't think I was going to have much of a relationship, and it turned out to be a great relationship.
All right. Jim, this is the reflective Donald Trump. This is not the 3 a.m., tweeting with both thumbs angrily, Donald Trump. He was very calm and measured.
This is a man who has been subject to many, many briefings by this point. He's the guy who's now been told that the Russians are trying to rebuild relationships with the Taliban in Afghanistan, even when U.S. troops are on the ground. He's the one who's been told that Russia's best friend in the Mideast is Iran.
Right.
So I think what you do see is a lot of reality kind of coming to grips. And also remember, he's saying this with the British Prime Minister at his side.
Right.
And that is the top concern of all Europe now, is whether the U.S. will participate in the effort to...
In the NATO alliance to counterbalance
Russia.
Yeah. Right, and he's saying this after he spent time with one of our strongest allies. And so she was able to talk about the rest of the world. And I think he probably heard things that... You know, he wasn't used to hearing from another world leader.
You know what I was fascinated by? He didn't say it explicitly, but what I heard in that answer, and the reason I let it play out a little longer, is Trump still a transactional guy. He talks about, you know, I've had people I thought I'd get along with and I didn't, and then people I didn't think and I did. And it's still for him, there's this framing of things almost like what he was as a business leader, right? It's interesting.
He's still a deal maker, and that's why this phone call is so important. It will set the tone on the relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Nan, what did you hear? What do you think about this relationship that we're not quite clear about right now in terms of Trump and Putin?
Well, it's been called a bromance for some time now, and I do think that there have been compelling statements by national security experts around the danger of failing to understand who Vladimir Putin is, what his record is, and where he seeks to go at the head of the country. You know, he's managed to take over despite all the elections and the shape-shifting that's been going about who's the president and who's the prime minister over there. He is, I think, you know, that relationship is very significant in terms of geopolitics, and it should be handled carefully. And when I hear Wendy Sherman, the past Assistant Secretary of State, who actually walked in the streets in Washington last Saturday with her boss, former Secretary Kerry, talked, and she helped negotiate the Iran deal. And when they talk in very sophisticated terms about the complexities and the nuance of world politics, we're poised on the on a blade here about which way things go.
All right,
high stakes.
Jim, let's turn to Mexico, and then we'll listen to one last soundbite from Trump and move on to other business. But I think it's really important that we discuss this. The president, of course, was supposed to have the president of Mexico coming to the White House shortly after Theresa May. It was going to be the second visit by a state leader. And they got into a war of words over the building of the wall and who was going to pay for it. Trump said, no, Mexico will pay for it. And they're going to pay for it because we're going to put a 20% tariff on Mexican goods coming into the United States. At which point, President Peña Nieto said, no, I'm not coming to the White House. This is off the table. We are not going to move forward with this. Your thoughts?
Well, this was after the Twitter message that says if he's not willing to talk about the wall, maybe he shouldn't come. So it was kind of an invitation to collapse. I think, again, what we're seeing here is a president who is finally being surrounded by people who can tell him what the danger of a Twitter message poses, because you had a diplomatic meltdown over this whole thing.
Right.
And Trump tried to repair that today with an hour-long phone call.
Right.
On that. But what's interesting is that it brought out that 20% tariff on imported goods coming into the country. That's part of a House Republican plan.
Right.
And it would affect it. They weren't ready to talk about that. And what that did is it put a topic on the table that they weren't ready to go there yet.
But you know who was? The National Retail Association spokesperson said today that we're talking about a tax on consumers. We're talking about when you bring the goods across and you put that 20% tariff, you're directly going into the pocketbooks of Mr. and Mrs. Work in America.
It's not going to be Mexico building the wall. It'll be Walmart customers.
And that's why the chief of staff came out last night and said, well, there's a whole buffet of options.
Yeah, he definitely backed Trump on that one.
Well, let's listen to what Trump, of course, was asked by that. He ducked the question on the wall and who's going to pay for it, what appeared to be a feud with Peña Nieto. He didn't really say much about the phone call, although he was asked about it. So we at 3:24 on Friday afternoon, a few hours after this news conference, we still really don't know what the relationship is going to be between Mexico and the United States over the wall. Who's going to pay for it? The 20% tariff, right?
But there was a statement put out by the Mexican government saying that they've decided they're not going to talk
about
that.
Let's listen to what Trump did say about Mexico, and we'll then move on.
But as you know, Mexico, with the United States, has out-negotiated us and beat us to a pulp through our past leaders. They've made us look foolish. We have a trade deficit of $60 billion with Mexico. On top of that, the border is soft and weak. Drugs are pouring in, and I'm not going to let that happen. We have a very good relationship, the president and I. And we had a talk that lasted for about an hour this morning. And we are going to be working on a fair relationship and a new relationship.
Jim?
I think what you see here is a president. We sparked a discussion here of a fairly sophisticated international discussion here. If you put tariffs on goods coming in from Mexico to the United States, what do you do to the Mexican economy? And if you torpedo the Mexican economy, are you not then encouraging more people to come across, to slip across the border into the United States to find work. So I think we've got a president who's coming to grasp with the complications.
Yeah, but he is going to build the wall. And Greg Bluestein, that comes at a time when the data over crossings by undocumented Mexicans, undocumented people from Central America as well, are down like 40%.
That's right.
It isn't as if there is a rush to get across the border right now.
Yeah, but it shouldn't surprise anyone that he's
building
a wall.
Well, it's his campaign pledge.
Right. And I mean, everything that he's done this week should not surprise anyone. I mean, he's basically been talking about everything he talked about during the campaign.
And that's how I'd love to end this segment. And I'd love to get each of you to weigh in. It strikes me that although you can, he had a mixed week. Every time he did something that was on message and you know, dealt with things he'd promised in the campaign, he turned around and did something that detracted from it in one way or another. But, Eric, I'll start with you. It feels to me like this was a Steve Bannon week at the White House. This week showed us that Steve Bannon is in charge right now of the messaging and how they're going to deal with
it. Well, it's starting with his inaugural address. And he's basically talked about everything he said during the campaign. But then there's now evidence, as Jim pointed out, as he's getting data, as he's hearing from his advisors and people in the government, he's starting to realize that some of the things he said just are not realistic. Or they're a little bit more complicated.
I thought all the Bannon messages prevailed this week, Greg.
I did too. And at the same time, as measured as he might sound at that press conference, he's continued the early morning tweets. I mean, just this morning, it was a tweet about 3 million more illegal voters who helped Hillary Clinton win.
Again this morning,
around 8 a.m. in the morning. So he's still pursuing that track along the same line, pleasing probably a big chunk of his base doing that.
Well, another thing that's very troubling, we've not mentioned it yet, but that's the question of Muslims and nations that are primarily contain Muslim citizens. We're going down a dangerous, dark road when we reinstitute barring people on the basis of their religion. And the ACLU, among countless others, will be watching that very, very closely. It's a national security issue to attack a sector of your population and a sector of the globe based on religion.
I want to do one very quick fact check, and then we have to take a break. We've been talking about the wall, and I didn't ask the question, so allow me to jump back a step. Jim Galloway, the president can issue an executive order saying the wall will be built, but no executive order can determine whether Congress appropriates the money
$25 billion,
right?
Right, and that's what that's what you have to realize. Yes, you had a lot of executive orders. You had a lot of statements of "I'm going to do this now. I'm going to do that now." But you haven't. You really haven't had Republicans in Congress weigh in on whether they're going to let the president accomplish those things.
Okay. Well, and there was an example in Philadelphia at the meeting with both Speaker Ryan and Senator McConnell on the issue of torture. Right. And they jumped in and said, it's illegal. It's not going to happen.
All right. We've got to take a break because it's already 3:30 on Friday afternoon. Oh, Greg Bluestein,
time
the weekend
flies.
Really is getting closer. We're on Political Rewind. We're going to take a very short break and be back with more.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's Vehicle Donation Program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut, State Senator Nan Orica, the AJC's Greg Bluestein, Eric Tannenblatt, the Republican par excellence with us today, and Jim Galloway, the political writer for the AJC. By the way, you read Jim Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog. Greg Bluestein, you read on almost every front page of the AJC because his byline is everywhere. Yes, Galloway?
He's really a robot.
I've been called worse.
you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and a lot of you are doing that. Thought Crime says, Trump responds to the UK reporter. We talked about there was some humor set. He said, with satiric levity, was Reagan-esque. Surprised me completely. Dave tweets, the election is behind us. Really? Tell that to the real Donald Trump. Catherine Cummings, who knows what will happen? Trump has now come out for NATO. Which way is the wind blowing? Ted Barfield, Nan, who's one of our favorite Republican tweeters, says, Nan is used to going unchallenged on these panels. I don't think that's true at all.
If looks could kill.
Let's turn to some state issues. And Greg, because you're with us today, tell us about what it was like. You were in South Georgia with the governor on Wednesday. They had terrible devastation down there. And you went on the tour with him. Give us a feeling for what that was like down there, what you saw, and how you feel about the state and the federal response.
Yeah, remember, this was 3 or 4 days after the tornadoes had hit. There was still damage everywhere. There was debris as far as the eye could see. We went to the mobile home park in Adel, Georgia, which is just in sort of south central Georgia, where 7 people alone died in this one mobile home park. There were still stuffed animals and toys, pictures, you know, basically a family's livelihood just scattered still on this flat plain. Lonely pillars, brick pillars standing out from where homes used to be. You know, just devastation everywhere. And a small community, this county only has, Cook County only has about 17,000 people. Mm-hmm. Adel is only about 5,000 people. And when I was down there, I had discovered as well that the whole town was talking about it. Their emergency room
is closing
yeah. in yeah. a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's the ER served 15 people who, and some of those might have been among the deceased had not the ER been there to serve them. So the community is still reeling and still basically begging the hospital that runs the ER there in Tifton to reconsider their decision.
You know, that's, Nan,
yep.
right in the right heart of the problem that we face in Georgia, which is who is going to help rescue rural hospitals
that's right.
that serve the poorest Georgians. And you, your colleagues and you down at the Gold Dome cannot figure out an answer to that.
Oh, well, I've got answers. it's just that they've not been acted on. We could have already brought billions of federal dollars into our Georgia healthcare system had we expanded Medicaid like all but 19 governors did across the country. Additionally, we just took up in Finance Committee this week an effort to expand this let's give rural hospitals let's give tax credits for people that give rural hospitals money. Well, that has not been a fixer. That has not done the trick. I think about $900,000 has been raised with that. And if we just take the $50 million that we put in the budget for those tax credits and match it with federal money and cover people, we'd be way ahead of the game.
Yeah, but
way ahead of the game. We'd get $15 for every dollar.
But isn't that why you were dealing with that issue? Because the 60%, you raised it to 90% because that's why people weren't giving.
We didn't raise it to 90%, but they tried to. That'll be ongoing, Eric, throughout the thing.
That's now on the table.
But that's, yeah, I'm saying that's why they're tweaking on that.
Right.
Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, they said, let's let the insurance companies from all over the country come here and do business, bring policies. We fought that, but it passed. It has not changed things.
Let's go back to South Georgia for just a minute, Greg, because, again, President Trump, who likes to call attention to himself, shall we say, told Governor Deal, my team tells me we approved your request for federal aid in record time. Yes?
Yeah, and the governor kind of had a...
cleared his throat.
Yeah, cleared his throat, kind of had to sort of correct the president, saying, well, actually, you haven't even approved that that request yet. He was talking about a request from earlier this month, January 2nd, which was not in record time, by the way. Some of the requests were cleared in 2 or 3 days. This was about 20 days. But then he followed up yesterday and approved the request from this weekend storms. But then the governor's other response was, I've already heard from the new president twice in his first week in office. He said he had barely heard from President Obama, you know, more than a handful of times over the seven or so years that he was he had been governor when Obama.
You know, I think that's a really good point. Eric, Jim, whether you voted for, well, whether anyone, whoever voted for Trump or didn't vote for Trump, the fact of the matter is, there's no question that Georgia is up there in the president's sights. He's got, obviously, a Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, who's going to be approved despite the controversy. He's got Sonny Perdue as his Ag Secretary.
And now he has Stefan Passantino.
He's got Stefan Passantino, who we want to talk about in a minute, who's going to oversee ethics for the Trump administration.
Well, there's a job.
There is a joke in there somewhere, but somebody else can tell it. But David Perdue, who supported him from early on, Nick Ayers, who is close to Mike Pence.
Newt Gingrich.
So Georgia is likely to be smiled upon throughout the 4 years of the Trump administration, yes?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, and quite frankly, during the two Bush administrations, the two Bush presidencies, we got plenty of attention.
Yeah.
I mean,
Tannenblatt was here, and he raised more money for the Bushes
than anyone else on Earth. Are you important in the president's reelect?
Yeah.
That's right, because we're a state that's going blue. I don't hear anybody challenging that either.
We just watched the last two elections, so we'll see how that
turns out. I've heard that before.
Tell us about Passantino, because he's been a partner in your firm, Dettons.
He's actually, his office was two doors down from mine.
Okay, and his job now is?
He's doing similar work to what he was doing at the firm. He's a political law lawyer and focusing on ethics and compliance. And
he's in charge of ethics and
compliance. He's got a staff of four people in the White House. Right now, he's spending a lot of time dealing with all of these nominees as they go through their confirmation process, making sure they're all prepared for their confirmation hearings from an ethics. And it's cumbersome because the president has appointed people that are kind of challenging with, you know, a lot of affluent people. And so Stefan's very busy right now. But I feel very good about the administration as it relates to ethics, knowing Stefan, he's top-notch, and the president's lucky to have him.
Well, and he's about to become an expert in the emoluments clause of the Constitution.
Why don't you remind?
Indeed.
All right, explain to our listener. I know we keep hearing this word emoluments. Tell everybody what emoluments are.
Me or Eric?
Well, Eric. Well, you go ahead, Galloway.
Go ahead, Galloway. You brought it up.
It's essentially tips to the president.
This is the clause that says that a president cannot accept gifts from a foreign government,
right,
or titles of nobility or such. Now the question is, does that apply to Trump the corporation?
Yeah, and Passantino, one of the things that he will certainly be deeply enmeshed is the question about the new Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., which is,
by the way, is spectacular. I was there. It was beautiful.
I'll bet you were.
Beautiful.
But the point is, it's a lease from the federal government. Trump, by the way, appointed the guy who oversees the Trump Hotel in Washington, whose agency oversees it. But if foreign leaders start staying at that hotel to please Trump in some way, the question is, Nan, have they violated the emoluments clause? And Passantino is the guy who's going to have to litigate that
sort of
thing.
That's right. There are plenty of smart lawyers that believe he has. We've got a smart lawyer here in the room. I'm sure he.
And there are a lot that that don't think he has. So, you know, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it.
And it's not only that. I mean, this is a president who has refused to divest in the dozens or maybe hundreds of businesses he has a stake in.
That's right.
So anytime there's any sort of question of a conflict of interest, guess who will get to handle that? Stefan.
Hey, while we're talking about people who have some relationship to Georgia, part of the new administration, we had very interesting news. Everybody's been waiting to find out what job will Newt Gingrich be offered in the Trump administration. He's another one of Eric's partners over there at Dentons. And in fact, the job right now that they're looking at isn't for Newt, it's for
Callista, his wife.
Callista.
As the ambassador to the Vatican.
Holy See.
The Holy See. Exactly.
Oh, I thought you were
going to
say
cow.
Holy cow.
Holy cow, that's what I'm saying. Well, they always stay together. He said that she has to fix his hair every morning. That's a direct quote.
Well, I will tell you, number one, it helps explain a lot of Newt's writings over the last, many days. He has been a firm supporter of Donald Trump. And that helps explain it. What I find very, very unusual and kind of funny is that in the early days, and Eric, you'll remember this, in the early days of the rise of the evangelical voters in the Republican Party, the Vatican was just unheard of. In many cases, it just was not filled because of religious objections, Baptists in particular.
Yeah.
But now we've kind of got a very Catholic friendly view on the Republican side, so it's not a big deal.
Right, and you have a president who comes from New York, which has a very large Catholic community.
I don't know that if I were the Gingriches, I would want to hold this nomination up for much scrutiny. You're talking about sending to the Vatican a woman whose husband has had a couple of divorces. And it just strikes me that from a personal point of view, do you really want to get into that, Eric? Yeah.
Well, first of all, there's a lot of speculation. There's been a lot of speculation about a lot of things with this new administration. And I know that, I think the speaker, you talked to him and he confirmed that she's being considered. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to refrain until, she's actually.
And trust me, whoever makes the decision will hear from the Vatican as to whether such a U.S. nominee or an appointment would be accepted.
Right. I think that's right.
I think she'd be fantastic. And I might also add that Denton's has a Rome office. So Newt will also have a place where he could work.
Let's move on. Let's talk about some state politics.
Healthcare.
Well, before we get to health, let's take a couple things that are really popping this week, Nan, if we can. And I'll start with you. I asked it in the very, very beginning of the show. What's the difference between a casino and a destination resort, and why does it matter, Nan Orrick?
That's right. I've actually sat in the presence of those who now talk about destination resorts, and it's kind of jaw-dropping. It's a big elephant in the room. I think it's going to wind up consuming a lot of energy, a lot of attention, and turn out to be a central bill on the question of casino license.
Greg, we're talking about the fact that Brandon Beach and Ron Stevens dropped their bill the other day, which would allow for a constitutional amendment on whether Georgians want to have casino gambling in the state. But there's been this change of language because apparently casinos, you can tell us the backstory, that's a poison pill. But a destination resort, they're swimming, I assume.
Restaurants. And what this allows them to do is it allows them to say, look, 65% of the taxable income from these resorts will be from non-gambling sources. So it kind of improves the emphasis, the outlook on it.
I was saying, I think the difference between casinos and resort destinations are about 100 lobbyists who are being hired by these gambling outfits to change the debate. Right. And I think it's starting to sort of change the debate. We saw two big developments this week with the governor and Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed both saying, instead of their vocal opposition, which we saw in 2015 and parts of 2016, both of them are saying, we'll take a wait and see. They're kind of giving conditions for their support, or at least hedging their bets. And I think that's a big deal. Even though they both don't have a vote in the process, their opposition could give lawmakers cover to oppose it.
I think it's going to be about how much are we going to be at 30% or 20% or 15%? What's the state going to rake in revenues? And B, where it's going to go.
Right, and
I mean, where the
revenues will go.
Here's what Brandon Beach has put on the table. He has said bottom floor, and this is the floor. He said it could go higher, but he said a 30% of the gambling revenue, the taxable income that comes in, could go to needs based scholarships. For Georgia College students.
Nan, are you going to vote for this measure the way you see it right now? What kind of questions ask before you do?
I've been around way too long to give away my vote on a Friday afternoon at this early in the process. The
Caucus has not taken a position yet.
No, and there are many views about this question of what would we fund with these dollars? What justifies making this move? Would it be needs-based scholarships? Would it be keeping rural hospitals open? Would it be health care in rural Georgia? Would it be trauma care for the entire state? And those are just a few that are on the table.
And supporters will certainly need Democratic votes. This being a two-thirds majority required, there'll be a lot of Republicans, especially in rural Georgia, that will say no way. They will never vote for gambling. Even
you'll need solid support from Democrats to pass this.
Eric, you're very in tune with and in touch with the Atlanta business community. You know the leaders of it quite well. AJ Robinson at Central Atlanta Progress. An organization that has a big impact on what happens in downtown Atlanta, has said he's a little dubious about casinos in Atlanta because he's worried about police around it, all the other services the city would have to pay for. Where do you think the business community is going to go with this?
I think they're split right now, and they're trying to get more information. And I think all these questions that AJ raised are all being addressed.
All right.
It's interesting, too. The arts community is very split on this as well. The Fox Theater is worried about competition. Some of the other Metro Atlanta theaters are worried about big competition from an MGM-type, grand theater that could fit 2,000 people and could steal all their shows.
But there's no doubt from an economic development standpoint, the number of jobs would be, tremendous, and the economic impact would be tremendous.
Jim, what do you think? Where's this headed? Probably by, because I shouldn't have said anything, I predicted at the right before the session, no way this is going to happen this session. This is two sessions down the road. I was wrong, it looks
like. You've had House Speaker David Ralston say that he hasn't made a position, he hasn't taken a position on it yet. So that's but he's allowing the possibility that this that it could happen.
But he also said on this air, don't bet on it, too. So
right, but what I was about to say, Greg, is watch Casey Cagle. This is the guy who's going to be running for governor
in
2018.
Right. That's right.
And watch where he goes. I think that'll determine whether this floats or not.
All right, let's do this. Let's take our final break of the show because it's already 3:47. When we come back, I'd like to talk about something that the next mayor of Atlanta is going to be definitely involved in what happens with casino gambling here. And we had our first gathering of candidates for mayor of Atlanta. And whether you're listening right now here in Atlanta or around the state, this is the city of Atlanta. This is the engine that drives it. So I think you're all pretty interested in what's going to happen here. We'll get to that right after a break. You're listening to Political Rewind.
How do movies get made? For a striking number of Oscar winners, it involves an anonymous survey called The Blacklist.
Hollywood's a huge machine, and the people that are still greenlighting the majority of films tend to be overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How to get out of a comic book superhero sequel-filled rut? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway and Greg Bluestein of the AJC are here. Eric Tannenblatt is with us, and so is State Senator Nan Orrick. Let me remind you once more, I'll give you the phone number. We'd love to have you let us know why you should be on our citizen panel. I've said before that when we did voter panels on the show, Jim, we had tremendous, people loved hearing what the voters had to say.
Oh, it was fun to do, too.
So we'll continue this throughout the year, hearing how you all feel as citizens of the United States now. 678-757-4472. Be succinct, please. Jim Galloway, the other day, the Buckhead Coalition, Sam Mazzell's organization, brought together for the first time, the eight declared candidates for mayor. We don't know that that's the whole pool, but those are the ones who were there.
The whole pool is slightly larger, but we'll say that those are the ones he judged to be viable.
Okay.
And I'll go with his judgment on that.
And I think there was another potential candidate there, but as the Fulton County Commission chair watching.
Yes.
John Eaves. Yes.
John Eaves, sure. All right, so give us some impressions about this thing.
Well, I think, number one, it's a free-for-all. I don't think anybody has a particular advantage. You've got your insiders, you've got your outsiders. This debate happened on Wednesday, and it was the same day that E.R. Mitchell Jr. Pled guilty in federal court for accepting for handing out bribes in City Hall for contracts.
Mitchell has been a big construction player, a big developer, and
he
construction.
And his father,
guy.
He and his father. Yeah. It's a double generation, and they've had a tremendous impact. Depending on what names he names, you know, this could it could have a huge impact on the race, because you have Cesar Mitchell, who's the council president running. You have Keisha Lance Bottoms, Kwanzaa Hall, Mary Norwood, all city members members of city council. Peter Amon was the COO for Kasim Reed for a couple of years. You've got great ties to City Hall there, and so you had one of the people. Eric will tell you if he agrees, but one of the people who did kind of pop out a little bit was Vincent Fort, the state senator who very much kind of pitched himself as the outsider.
Yeah, I didn't think he did very good. I mean, he did stand out from the others, you know, in that. I didn't think
it was a business climate.
He didn't fit in. I did find it interesting. Mary Norwood to me looked like she was picking up right where she left off. She was even on message from her last campaign for mayor.
And we have to remind people how close she came to being almost
700 votes.
Right, right. And it was the first time a lot of people saw Peter Amon in that setting as a candidate. And Cesar Mitchell, obviously, is the council president, probably has a high profile. And then Kathy Willard. I thought Kathy Willard did a good job, too. But it was interesting because you could tell what issues each of these candidates are going to run on.
Well, and that was going to be my next question. Nan Oreck, what if you were going to be a candidate for mayor? What are the issues? What should people be running on? What will they be running on?
Well, one is an assessment of what's the performance at this point. You know, when you run as an outsider, for example, you've got to be condemning and finger pointing, and that's a challenge.
So you're going to be challenging the mayor, Kasim Reed, and okay, go ahead.
And the question of poverty, that's a problem not solved, and really some dreadful parts of our city that need much more attention than they're getting. You've got the school board people jumping into these races for the city council seats. You're going to have a free for all in terms of the city council seats that have emptied out. The question of whether this mayor is going to be one that continues to cultivate and nurture a relationship with the governor of another party, or not. That's right. That'll be one that'll be before the voters.
And that's what's so fascinating to me about Vincent Fort's candidacy. You know, whoever, if it's a Democrat who wins, they become a de facto leader of the state Democratic Party, if not the most prominent Democrat. And you've got Vincent Fort, who is an anti-establishment Democrat, who is running against City Hall, as he said at the Buckhead Coalition meeting. He makes it very clear he's running against City Hall.
But he's being backed by Roy Barnes.
Yeah. He's being backed by establishment Dems. And you know, he is running on a Sanders platform to decriminalize marijuana and to make college tuition at Atlanta City's colleges for free. I think his candidacy has an opportunity to polarize this entire race.
And on the other part of this is, of course, you've got people like Cesar Mitchell who are trying to take Kasim Reed down a notch or two, and you know it was interesting. I mean, Kasim Reed is really really liked in Buckhead. I mean, they really we are in the middle of a commercial boom that we haven't seen. I was sitting next to the fellow who heads up the Midtown Alliance, who said they've never seen this many cranes in their part of the city ever before. Yeah. So you know, so you've got on one hand you do have sections many sections of Atlanta that are steeped in poverty, but you've got some tremendous sections that are just booming. Right,
you know,
now.
Nan touched on something too that I think is worth you know commending Mayor Reed is the relationship between the city and the state, and Mayor Reed has done a really good job working with Governor Deal. And I could tell you from my vantage point when I was working for Governor Perdue, that was not the case with Governor Perdue and Mayor Franklin.
Right.
And I was right in the middle of that, if you remember the water sewer issue we were dealing with back then. And it does make a difference when the capital city leader and the governor of the state get along. And
you know, I'm sorry, finish your sentence.
No, that's...
You know, it's fascinating. Shirley has been in here a number of times recently. She was just here the other day. And once again, off air, we said to her, well, do you want to get into this race? Because there's been talk that she may want to. And she continues to say, I'm going to keep my options open. Now, that just might be game playing. But it's interesting, Jim.
It's interesting, but I think, look, I think Maynard Jackson learned very quickly that it's not as much fun the second time around as it is the first time.
Yeah, I think I've told this story.
I think that's a consideration that she has.
I think that's right. I told this story on the air before, but very quickly, when Maynard Jackson came back to serve what was his third term after leaving office and coming back and winning,
that's right.
I just happened to walk back to his city hall office with him after the swearing in. He sat down at the desk, and I looked at him, and the expression that came over his face as he sat down at that desk and looked at the papers on it was, "What the heck did I do this for?" And I think Shirley has a little of that in her, Greg.
Yeah, and from all, by all accounts, she's enjoying her life right now. She's still involved in national Democratic politics. She was co-chair of the platform committee, so she's still very involved. But to run for city mayor again, and especially among this crowded field, where it's still not a guarantee she'd even make a runoff.
Right.
But I do think that if she, I'm presuming that she won't get into the race.
Right.
But who she backs is going to be very important.
Very important.
And we could have a race where Reid is backing one candidate and Shirley is backing another.
Jim, let me.
And Roy Barnes is backing another.
Right.
Jim, early on at least, Kathy Willard made quite a big issue out of the amount of money the city and the state were putting into essentially a football field, $1.5 billion Arthur Blank football field.
A team we've all heard of,
yeah,
yes.
And so it's interesting, as the Super Bowl approaches, is she going to start backing away from that? Because suddenly the Falcons are so popular that I'm not sure you can continue.
I think Vincent Ford also was critical of the deal. I think at least for the next 6 months, you put that item in abeyance there, and you don't talk about it.
She brought up the belt line, because if you think about it,
she was the one who started that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right.
What's fascinating about that is that she was the one who really sparked everything as president of city council, right? Mm-hmm. And then she was pushed aside. And she has never quite gotten over that, I think, personally. That's been an issue that has hurt her deeply. And she's become critical of some of what's gone on, Greg Bluestein, on the Beltline because of having been pushed aside.
She has. And you're seeing both her and Senator Ford stake out the anti-mayor territory there. And when the mayor was asked about both of their negative comments, he only went after Kathy Willard. He ignored Vincent Ford entirely.
All right. One last comment from you.
I would throw in Caesar Mitchell as the anti-mayor because he's going after the streetcar, the Atlanta streetcar.
Okay.
Fertile ground.
We are completely out of time. A great conversation. Senator Nan Ora, Greg Bluestein, Eric Tannenblatt, Jim Galloway, thank you all so much for really interesting conversation. Remember that if you can't listen to us when we're on the radio, you can subscribe to our podcast, the Political Rewind podcast, on iTunes, or if you're an Android user, whatever the heck you get your podcast from. And our shows are all archived on our website. But as we've said before, you can now listen to the show by going to the Political Insider blog at AJC.com, and we're there 3 days a week, thanks to Mr. Galloway's helping us get those posted. So we enjoy that a lot. We're out of time. If you want to continue the conversation, tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We'll be back on Monday afternoon. We're going to reunite Farron Johnson and Jackie Cushman, two of our favorite Democrat and Republican contenders. That ought to be fun. We'll see you, too, on Monday. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a great weekend.